Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. It's time to learn American English and to hear about important world events at the same time. Asian aviation and cattle raising in Africa are coming your way right now on As It Is. Taiwanese officials are protesting China's plan to open 4 civilian air routes that would conflict with Taiwan's own flight paths. Under the plan, Chinese airplanes would fly over waters that divide the mainland from Taiwan. The complaint against China comes at a time of increasing tensions between the two sides. Bob Doty has more on the story.
China announced this month that it would open 4 new flight paths over the Taiwan Strait. The announcement came at a meeting of the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization. Chinese officials were reported as saying the new flight paths will help ease flight delays between Shanghai and the Pearl River Delta. They said the changes will take effect in March. Officials in Taipei have protested the Chinese decision. They say the new flight paths conflict with existing routes near Taiwan's main island and 2 smaller groups of islands. Taiwanese airline companies and the island's Air Force say they have no immediate plans to make changes because of the Chinese announcement. Jean Chen is the director of the Taiwan Civil Aeronautics Administration. She told reporters she expects China to negotiate further with her government. She says, when you establish a new flight path, you need to negotiate and communicate with neighboring governments. She hopes Taiwan can follow up with continued talks with mainland China about the situation. As it is, she says, Taiwan's side cannot accept it. Political observers say Taiwan will make more protests like this in 2015 to resist China because of increasing public resentment. China has claimed control of self-ruled Taiwan since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s. Tensions between the two sides have kept the Taiwan Strait heavily militarized. Since President Ma Ying-jeou took office in Taiwan in 2008, the two sides have eased tensions and opened talks, leading to 21 economic agreements. But many Taiwanese are critical of the ruling Nationalist Party for growing too friendly with China's government. Last month, the party was defeated in local elections. It will face a difficult fight in presidential elections next year against an opposition that wants to move slowly on improved ties with China. Some Taiwanese worry that China will eventually try to use economic links to gain control of the island. China's agency responsible for relations with Taiwan said this week it had already discussed the new flight paths with Taipei. It asked Taiwan to be more understanding and less worried. The Chinese side says the new routes would ease travel between Shanghai and airports in the heavily populated area north of Hong Kong. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The International Crisis Group reported last month that a hidden conflict is taking place in rural parts of the Central African Republic. Christopher Cruz reports.
The conflict is between cattle herders and farmers. The herders are mostly Muslims from the Pearl ethnic group. Most of the farmers are either Christians or animists. Animists believe that animals, plants, and other things in nature have spirits, just as human beings do. Officials are attempting to stop the conflict and to prevent new violence in the country. A group of livestock experts recently visited rural parts of the Central African Republic. The group included representatives of a National Alliance of Cattle Herders, international aid groups, the United Nations, and government agencies. The experts found that cattle growers and their animals are generally not welcome in agricultural areas. Clashes develop when the growers come under attack. The farmers attack the herders, who then answer with their own attacks. Very often, the clashes take on religious or ethnic overtones. One side attacks the other for what appears to be religious or ethnic reasons. Some people displaced by the unrest live at a camp in the town of Bunbury. They say they fled there because of attacks by Pearls. This man, Yagbanga Biani, says Christians like him are being hurt because the Pearls are attacking Christians. He says that is why they sought protection at the camp. The Central African Republic has a population of 5 million. Most of them are Christian. The Pearls are usually Muslim. Aid workers say about 1,000 Christians have been coming to Bunbury every week to escape dangerous conditions in their home villages. The attacks on villages are often designed to answer violence against the Pearls. Ngeri Bisekoa told VOA that the Pearls attacked his village and burned many houses. He says the attackers thought the area was occupied by Christian and animist militias known as anti-Balaka. The violence around Bunbury has mainly happened on two roads leading south. These roads appear to be the front lines between the anti-Balaka and the Pearls. Many of the Pearls have been forced from land where their animals once fed. Much of Bunbury is under the control of a militia leader named Ali Darassa. He has created a movement called the Union for Peace in the CAR, or UPC. Those letters come from the French name for the group. Captain Ahmad Nijad is a spokesman for the group. He blamed the anti-Balaka for most of the burned villages. But he admitted that the Muslims have sometimes used violence to answer the attacks. However, he says, even if Muslims sometimes burn a village, they have a reason to do so. He says if the Christian militia group did not attack Pearls, Muslims would not answer with violence. In the Central African Republic, cattle often move from north to south at this time of year. Livestock experts are warning there could be more violence during this seasonal migration. The group says the government should place peacekeeping troops near the border with Chad to help reduce violence. It also says that providing vaccination services for cattle might persuade herders to follow suggested trails instead of having their animals walk on farmland and crops. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the voice of America.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Many science fiction stories tell about explorers arriving in a new world. The explorers then use some kind of high-tech device to test for breathable air or signs of life. But here on Earth, science fiction is becoming reality through a new sampling technology called environmental DNA, or eDNA for short. Scientists can use it to identify rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish populations with just a little air or water. Ryan Kelly is an ecologist at the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington in Seattle. He works in a laboratory there with other researchers. They study the genetic material released by living creatures.
Essentially, we can take a sample of whether it's soil or air, and in our case, water, and we can sequence the DNA out of it and tell you what's there.
Ryan Kelly says he and his research team are studying water samples collected from Puget Sound. He says the cost of gene sequencing has plummeted in recent years. That makes DNA testing more widely available. Environmental DNA can be used in two ways. One is to identify the creatures that live in a certain place. The other is to confirm the presence or lack of a specific creature. Karen Goldberg heads the new eDNA lab at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. She is one of the first biologists in the northwestern United States to take the technology from the testing phase to actually using it.
It's extremely useful for species that are really hard to find. I have spent many hours looking for species that I was pretty sure were there, looking under rocks, looking in water, doing all kinds of surveys.
Karen Goldberg sees eDNA as a way to get answers more efficiently, safely, and with less destruction compared to traditional survey techniques. Until recently, scientists depended on snorkeling, netting, or using an electric current to temporarily capture fish.
We're absolutely at this point where proof of concept has been established. I don't think everyone necessarily is on board yet, but I think a majority of the people are on board.
This newer way to identify what lives in the environment is becoming popular around the world. Animal experts in Vietnam are using the eDNA to find the last wild Yangtze giant softshell turtles. One researcher on the Caribbean island of Trinidad is using the sampling technology to find endangered golden tree frogs. And in Madagascar, it is being used to identify amphibian diseases. Ms. Goldberg has used eDNA testing to confirm the local extinction, disappearance, of a leopard frog in the American state of Idaho. She has also been asked to document the spread of the New Zealand mud snail in the state of Washington. The creature has been found in lakes and other waterways across the state. Now, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management wants Karen Goldberg to look for the Columbia spotted frog in two other western states. The rare amphibian is a candidate for the federal government's threatened species list. Scientists working with the technology say they do not expect robots to replace field biologists anytime soon. But the old-fashioned fieldwork could soon be more targeted. A related research goal is to show how long environmental DNA can last and how far it can travel in different environments. And that's the Environment and Science Report from VOA Learning English. For more environment, science, and agriculture reports, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, this is Science in the News. Today, Shirley Griffith and Christopher Cruz tell the stories of some medical heroes.
At the start of the 20th century, the United States Army had a yellow fever commission. The Army wanted medical experts to study yellow fever and find a way to stop the disease. One team went to Cuba to test the idea that mosquitoes spread yellow fever. The team was led by Walter Reed, the Army doctor and scientist noted for his work on infectious diseases. In August of 1900, the researchers began to raise mosquitoes and infect them with the virus. 9 of the Americans let the infected insects bite them. Nothing happened. Then 2 more let the mosquitoes bite them. Both men developed yellow fever.
A doctor named Jesse William Lazier recognized that the mosquitoes that bit the last 2 men had been older than the others. Dr. Lazier proved that mosquitoes did carry yellow fever. Dr. Lazier himself was also bitten. No one is sure how it happened. He said it happened accidentally as he treated others. But some people said he placed the mosquito on his arm as part of the experiment. Medical historians say he may have reported the bite as an accident, so his family would not be denied money from his life insurance policy.
Jesse Lazier died of yellow fever. His death shocked the others on the team in Cuba, but they continued their work. More people let themselves be bitten by mosquitoes. Others were injected with blood from the victims of yellow fever. Some people in this test group developed the disease, but all recovered to full health. Members of the team praised the work by Jesse Lazier. They called it a sacrifice to research that led the way to one of the greatest medical discoveries of the century.
The research answered the question of how yellow fever was spread. Now the question was how to protect people. The researchers had a theory. They thought that people who were bitten by infected mosquitoes, but recovered, were protected in the future. To test this idea, the team in Cuba offered $100 to anyone who would agree to be bitten by infected mosquitoes. 19 people agreed. The only American was Clara Moss. She was a nurse who worked with yellow fever patients in Cuba. Clara Moss was bitten by infected mosquitoes 7 times between March and August of 1901. Only one of the 19 people developed the disease until that August. Then, 7 people got yellow fever. Clara Moss died 6 days after she was bitten for the 7th time.
The experiment showed that the bite of an infected mosquito was not a safe way to protect people from yellow fever. Medical historians say the death of Clara Moss also created a public protest over the use of humans in yellow fever research. Such experiments ended. Cuba and the United States both honored Clara Moss on postage stamps. And today, a hospital in her home state of New Jersey is known as the Clara Moss Medical Center.
Joseph Goldberger was a doctor for the United States Public Health Service. In 1912, he began to study a skin disease that was killing thousands of people in the South. The disease was pellagra. Dr. Goldberger traveled to the state of Mississippi, where many people suffered from pellagra. He studied the victims and their families. Most of the people were poor. The doctor came to believe that the disease was not infectious, but instead related to diet. He received permission from the state governor to test this idea at a prison. Prisoners were offered pardons if they took part. One group of prisoners received their usual foods, mostly corn products. A second group ate meat, fresh vegetables, and milk. Members of the first group developed pellagra. The second group did not.
But some medical researchers refused to accept that a poor diet caused pellagra. For the South, pellagra was more than simply a medical problem. There were other issues involved, including Southern pride. So Dr. Goldberger had himself injected with blood from a person with pellagra. He also took liquid from the nose and throat of a pellagra patient and put them into his own nose and throat. He even swallowed pills that contained skin from pellagra patients. An assistant also took part in the experiments. So did Dr. Goldberger's wife. None of them got sick. Later, the doctor discovered that a small amount of dried brewer's yeast each day could prevent pellagra. Joseph Goldberger died of cancer in 1929. He was 55 years old. Several years later, researchers discovered the exact cause of pellagra, a lack of the B vitamin known as niacin.
Matthew Luquia was the medical administrator of St. Mary's Hospital in the Gulu district of northern Uganda. In 2000, the hospital was the center of treatment for an outbreak of Ebola. The virus causes severe bleeding. No cure is known. Doctors can only hope that victims are strong enough to survive. Dr. Luquia acted quickly to control the spread of infection. He kept the people with Ebola separate from the other patients. He ordered hospital workers to wear protective clothing and follow other safety measures. One day, he had to deal with a patient who was dying of Ebola. The man had been acting out of control. The doctor knew him well. the patient was a nurse who worked at the hospital. The man was coughing and bleeding. Dr. Luquia violated one of his own rules. He wore no protection over his eyes. Matthew Luquia died from the virus in December of 2000. He was only 42 years old. Ugandans mourned his death. He was an important influence in the community. Experts say his work during the outbreak helped stop the Ebola virus from spreading out of control.
On February 28, 2003, the Vietnam-France Hospital in Hanoi asked Carlo Urbani for help. The Italian doctor was an expert on communicable diseases. He was based in Vietnam for the World Health Organization. The hospital asked Dr. Urbani to help identify an unusual infection. He recognized it as a new threat. He made sure other hospitals increased their infection control measures. On March 11th, Dr. Urbani developed signs of severe acute respiratory syndrome. 4 days later, the World Health Organization declared it a worldwide health threat. Carlo Urbani was the first doctor to warn the world of the disease that became known as SARS. He died of it on March 29, 2003. He was 46 years old.
Our final medical hero is an American, molecular biologist Anita Roberts. She was widely recognized by other researchers for her work with a protein called transforming growth factor beta. TGF-beta can both heal wounds and make healthy cells cancerous. In 1976, Anita Roberts joined the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. She worked for many years with another researcher, Michael Sporn. They found that TGF-beta helps to heal wounds and is important in the body's defense system against disease. At the same time, though, the two scientists found that the protein can also support the growth of cancer in some cells.
Between 1983 and 2002, Anita Roberts published more than 340 research papers. Many other scientists gave credit to her published work. In fact, the publication Science Watch listed her as the 49th most cited researcher in the world during that 20-year period. She was the third most cited female scientist. But in 2004, after years of studying cancer, Anita Roberts learned that she herself had the disease. She died of gastric cancer in May of 2006. She was 64 years old.
This program was written by George Grow. Your announcers were Shirley Griffith and Christopher Cruz. Join us again next week at this time for more news about science on The Voice of America.